I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every morning, we awake to a world marvelously alive. Where do we encounter awe and wonder in this world? In animals and plants, in deserts, on mountains, in forests, ocean, and sky, in history, art, and science, in human striving and human kindness. Join us as we quest for the awe and wonder of knowing we are part of something infinitely larger than ourselves.
So, it's one thing to have book knowledge, and it's a completely different thing to have the actual knowledge in your bones, in your muscles. And so it was funny, my husband noted that when things started to go awry a couple weeks into the beekeeping experience, my husband said, you know, I don't think I've ever seen you this nervous or intimidated by anything before.
Intimidated by beekeeping? Well, Jessica Leahy is a competent and successful writer, teacher, and podcast host. But as you just heard, beekeeping might be a whole different thing. Exciting, but potentially quite nerve-wracking. Today, we'll hear Jess describe her beekeeping journey, an ongoing adventure for her. She's discovered that this activity isn't just about bees. It's also about how to stay open to learning, and how, with that openness, we are better able to find wonder in the good and bad around us. This is the kind of thing that somebody just, you don't just wake up one day and decide, I'm going to have bees. And I want to know about the mindset, the frame of reference you had for even wanting this. And how long did it take you to get going?
When I was in seventh grade, I believe, I had a math teacher who was a beekeeper, and he was hopelessly dorky. Like we may have even used the word beekeeper. He's a beekeeper of all things, as a derisive sort of way of talking about it. But on the other hand, you know, I grew up outside and I raised my kids in a place where they were sort of outside all the time. I live in New England, and here, you know, things don't stop just because bad weather. You get out there, you do it. And it, in the back of my head, I knew this was something I wanted to do someday. Luckily, I have a friend from college who over 10 years ago, decided to do a YouTube channel. His YouTube channel is Vino Farm, Vino for wine, because he was going to do grapes at one point. And he decided to just record his journey as a beekeeper with all the ugly failures. And of course, my first book was called The Gift of Failure. So when he went into it with all the failures included that people could learn from, if he was going to learn from them, I was all in. So I've watched all of his content. So he's really become my mentor, both in real life and online. And I just kept putting it off because there's so much to learn. And I moved to a place in Vermont in the woods, and I knew that I was going to have to do a lot of planting for the bees. And so it's taken a long time for me to accumulate both the gardening knowledge and the bee knowledge. And I finally felt like I was ready when a beehive dropped in my lap. My neighbor moved and decided the project that he had in his mind, this great beekeeping adventure, was never going to happen for him. And so he gave it to me with the promise of that if honey ever came out of this, he would get some.
So these were kind of foster bees.
Actually, I purchased the beehive. There's a place here in Vermont called Northwoods Apiary, and I purchased what's called a nuke. You can purchase like a small colony that comes with a couple of frames of brood, baby bees, and some resources like honey and pollen and things like that. Had to order that months in advance. And so the big day arrived, and we drove up there and picked up my bees.
If you're new to any of this, a frame of brood is the hive's nursery. The frame holds hexagonal wax cells, and these cells hold eggs that turn into larvae, that turn into pupae, all the early stages of a bee's development. The pupae are packed in with provisions like pollen and honey. So because these frames containing the brood are the bee nursery, they are the foundation for the whole colony. Now back to Jess Leahy. That day, that moment, picking up bees, relive it for me.
It was so good. The drive. So I don't know if you've ever heard the saying, but in New England, you can't get there from here. And so you can't really drive east-west in New England. You can only drive north-south. So it takes a long time if you're trying to go east-west, which is what we were doing. We had to drive through the mountains and it was so beautiful. And you pull up. And I did not know what this was going to be like, but you pull up and there are about 100 beehives out there in a field with a big electric fence around them, bees everywhere in the air, and a big line of cars waiting for pickup time. And I was ready with my laundry bag because someone told me that sometimes the bees can get loose from the box they give them to you in. And so if you're an enclosed car, you're going to want a laundry mesh bag. So I had that. And when our turn came, we were like 15 cars back. We pulled up and I handed them the bag and they put the bees in the back seat of our car and we were off. It was pretty wonderful.
Had you been hanging around apiaries and walking through fields and clovers and exposing yourself to it all?
Absolutely. So there are a lot of beekeepers in my area. There's a Vermont beekeeping group. There's the Vermont Bee Lab is at an educational agricultural site right near me, near the University of Vermont. I'm a member of both the Vermont Beekeepers Association and the Vermont Women's Beekeeping Group. And what's fun about going to those meetings, we had one recently about looking for varroa mites, which is the big killer that's been taking out a lot of bees. They had a meeting about that. And the people who showed up, there were like 30 women, and some didn't even have bees yet and were just planning, and some had been keeping bees for many, many, many years. And there's a lot of, not controversy, but a lot of discussion. Beekeepers tend to be fairly polite people. There's a lot of discussion about how one should manage varroa mites. Do you treat whereby you make your varroa mites more resistant to the chemicals? Do you use, you know, toxic chemicals that do the full blast? Or do you use organic chemicals? Or do you put herbs by the opening of a hive in order to deter them in the first place? There's so many different ways to handle it. So I loved seeing all these women from total beginner to expert all learning from each other.
Were you getting a little bit prematurely nerdy about it?
Okay, let me just explain something to you here. If you could see what's happening in my office right now, this room is filled with books. I host a podcast on writing in the publishing industry. It's called #AmWriting. My joke on that podcast is that I could spend the rest of my life researching, but not actually writing the books that I'm interested in writing. I am a super nerd. I love the research. So if there's something that I'm interested in, chances are I own every book on the subject or have borrowed them from the library and have every article on every subject. I love
it. Well, okay, if this is the case with you, then here you are. You had endless books about beekeeping. You'd been thinking about it for years. You go down there, you wait in line, you're number 15 in line, you get your bees, you get back in the car. Any misgivings whatsoever at that point?
Not the first day. So I have all the books and I had watched all the videos and all that sort of stuff. But beekeeping is something that requires a certain amount of muscle memory. How you manipulate the frames and how you move around bees is really important. I hadn't had the opportunity to practice a lot. So it's one thing to have book knowledge, and it's a completely different thing to have the actual knowledge in your bones, in your muscles. And so it was funny, my husband noted that when things started to go awry a couple weeks into the beekeeping experience, my husband said, you know, I don't think I've ever seen you this nervous or intimidated by anything before. And I said, I am. I said, I feel like I have to rehearse in my head and I don't want to kill any bees, but you inevitably kill a couple bees and I want to do right by them. This is a huge responsibility. I'm responsible for these many thousands of lives and it's on me. Plus, it's intimidating. The one thing that people don't really talk about is I happen to have slightly more aggressive bees. I found this out when I went to the Vermont Bee Lab and was in their bee yard, and their bees are so calm. Like you could meditate there in their bee yard. My bees are not like that. And so what happens is, no matter how much smoke you use to calm them down, there's all this sort of getting louder and louder buzzing all around you. And the amygdala, the part of your brain that really sparks the like fight or flight response or freeze, is saying to you, this is not right. You need to get out of here. And so I'm trying to do things very calmly while the primitive part of my brain is saying, no, no, this is wrong. Go, 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 go. So, you know, I think it's just a matter of, for me anyway, it's going to be a matter of practice and of learning how to deal with various situations. I didn't know, for example, that you shouldn't blow on bees because it upsets them. And I spent the first couple times I was in the hive trying to blow a bee away from something I was trying to look at, not realizing I was inadvertently making them very upset with me. It's not an easy process. Humans have been raising bees for millennia, but it's anything but simple.
Well, that's one very small thing that can go wrong if you inadvertently or maybe intentionally blow on a bee. But we want to talk about some of the big things that went south.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to spill it right here. You live in bear country.
I do. And oh, the hubris I had by not purchasing. I'm also fairly cheap. Yankees are very frugal, and I'm a born and bred Yankee. So I did not purchase my electric fence. They're so expensive. So I didn't purchase it right off the bat. I knew we had bears in the area because I have game cameras and I know what's out there. We have bobcats, we have bears, we have raccoons and skunks and all the things. And so I knew that this could be a possibility. And I knew that they could smell honey. They can smell honey from up to 2 miles away. So where my beehive is located is in the center of what looks like a big amphitheater. My house is built on the side of a mountain, and they created like a semicircle. And I cleared some trees from that area, and in order to prevent erosion, I planted a massive wildflower meadow. So it's essentially a semicircle of wildflowers. In the very center of it are a couple of beautiful white birch trees, and in the center of that little clearing is the beehive. So every morning when I leave my bedroom, I look out my window to see if the hive was still there. And one morning, it wasn't anymore.
I'm just kind of envisioning cartoonishly that a couple of bears had come over and hoisted it up in the air and carried it away. What did they actually do?
Every morning, it's the thing I look for every single morning, and it had been toppled over. Both the brood box, the bottom box that's big, and then a slightly smaller box on top of that, and its little roof had all been knocked right over. And so there was just nothing on that stand anymore. A bear had either come in from uphill or left by uphill because there was a big trampled path leading up through the wildflowers.
I'm sure you walked out there to inspect it. Were you shaken with rage? Were you dumbfounded? I mean, what was your reaction?
Number one, extremely guilty. This was my fault, right? I live in bear country. It is not their fault that they're going for. And by the way, the bears are not just interested in the honey, like we see Winnie the Pooh with his honey jar. Yes, they love honey. It's delicious. It's, you know, it's sweet. What they really, really love, though, are the larvae and the pupa, because that's extremely high in fat and protein for the bears. And especially this time of year, we're about to head into winter, and our bears around here are going to have to hide out for the winter in their little dens. And they need as much fat and protein as they can get. So this is an incredible source. You know, bravo to them for being able to sniff it out and find it. But I felt incredibly guilty and a little bit of shame because I knew better and I could have done better for my bees. It wasn't even, I can say, a lesson learned because I knew better going in.
As I'm listening to you speak, I kind of get a sense that this guilt or regret or remorse, it goes deeper than just sort of a matter of principle. It's almost like those little beings are alive and you care about them.
So when you research as much as I do, you get to learn a lot about the creatures or the plants or the whatever that you're learning about, right? Bees are insanely fascinating. They're so interesting and they're so complicated, and the way they live and how they live, and the queen is the center of the hive. There are very few males. Most of the hive is female, and this one bee, this one queen bee, can lay 2,000 eggs a day. Like, that's all she does, is she lays eggs. She has little attendants. They bring everything to her, and if she's dead, then that's it for my hive. A couple of different things can happen. There are a couple of scenarios. They could swarm. They'll probably make another queen. They're very resilient. But either way, you know, all of the work I've done to help them build up the strength of their hive. We have long winters here in Vermont, so they need every bit of resource they can get. And with this bear taking away the honey or possibly destroying baby bees, hundreds and hundreds of baby bees, you know, that's all on me. That is all on me. So yeah, I felt a massive responsibility for them. The more you know something, the more you understand and admire. You come to understand just how little we fully understand about bees, but how complicated and how amazing they are and how awe-inspiring they are as a creature, as a thing that exists on this planet and does not, P.S., need us at all. Like, they're going to be fine. If they swarmed and took off and became wild bees out in the woods, they'd probably do better than in my contraption that makes it easier for me to harvest honey or check on them. They'd be fine without me. But I am a steward. I'm supposed to be taking care of them. And I have failed because it wasn't even lack of foresight. It was hubris, which is the worst kind of oversight.
Yeah. Have you bear-proofed your operation?
Now I have, yes. So the fencing came in. I did what you're supposed to do, which is to put some peanut butter or bacon grease on a few of the little bits of the fence so that the bear will touch it with their lips and get a little shock. And by the way, I have shocked myself with this thing, and my dogs have been shocked by this thing too. It doesn't hurt them. It's a little surprising. And the bear has not returned since I set up my fence. And I set up the cameras so that it would see the spots where I smeared the peanut butter. I wanted to see it happen, that little bit of surprise, make sure that the bear knew about it. But either because the bear recognized the clicks of the fencing from something they'd encountered before or the flash of the light from the battery, it hasn't messed with my bees since.
Jessica Leahy is describing what she calls a massive responsibility that comes with donning a bee suit and bringing home a hive. In just a moment, our conversation takes an unexpected turn as she reflects on the ethical side of caring for insects like bees. Because when you take on responsibility for another living thing, you're not just deciding whether you care about it, you're deciding whether you'll care for it and what form that care will take. Leahy is the much-loved author of The Gift of Failure. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder.
As a dad myself, I know it's a happy moment when I come across a podcast just right for the whole family. And we've got just the thing for you, Constant Wonder Kids. Constant Wonder Kids offers stories from the original BYU radio podcast, Constant Wonder, with accessible adventures for younger hearts and minds. Constant Wonder Kids goes out into wide open nature. It's designed for curious kids, but then of course also for the grown-ups who love those kids. Together, you can discover fascinating facts, true stories about remarkable people we interview who have had incredible experiences in their own encounters with nature. You get to join them as they dive down far under the ocean surface to meet things like, oh, maybe a friendly whale shark? Or back on land, you get to cheer along for tiny little hedgehogs that are athletes, if you can believe it, at the International Hedgehog Olympic Games. Constant Wonder Kids is perfect for road trips, for bedtime listening, or whenever your brain's got an itch that needs to be scratched. New episodes drop on Mondays. Tune in to Constant Wonder Kids on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We now return to Constant Wonder. Jess and her husband know full well that if you meet up with a bear or any other fierce creature bearing teeth and claws, you could be in for real trouble. But such encounters with dangerous nature can offer something positive as well. What I heard next from Jess was really striking. She, together with her husband, have found these encounters useful in practicing empathy. When you come across a creature, human or animal, road rager or hungry carnivore, well, that animal comes with its own story, and that story is possibly completely legit. Our exposure to risk from animals, and this includes stinging or biting insects that we all too often think of as pests, well, that exposure calls for some mental and emotional processing. And if we're willing to rethink things a little, we might come up with some new, healthy perspectives.
So a background about bears a little bit, just so you understand my perspective. I used to live in a town in New Hampshire where one of our very well-known residents rescues orphaned bear cubs every year in New Hampshire. Mother bears are killed by cars or hunters or whatever, and the bears end up at his orphanage for baby bears. And they're collared and then they're released. And so I saw bears all the time. In fact, my son, my eldest, when he was in kindergarten, this bear expert came to his kindergarten class to talk to kids about what they should do when they see a bear, because you will see them. They're everywhere. So, you know, I would have bears eating my chicken feed. We had bears in our yard. My son has kicked soccer balls at bears to get them out of our yard. I understand bears and their right to their territory, and we're in it. That's just part of living in a place like Vermont. And also for background, my husband is an ethicist. He's an infectious diseases physician, and he has to do a lot of perspective taking and building empathy for his patients, whether it's a patient who's non-compliant with their medications or a patient who's angry and gets combative with the people who are just trying to help them. So when we get cut off in traffic, for example, we try to imagine that the person who has just cut us off or just honked at us or given us the finger or whatever, that person maybe had something awful happen to them that morning. You know, you can't really judge a person by what they do on their very worst day, and this could very well have been that person's very worst day. So we try really hard to have empathy for people. It's been increasingly difficult for us. My husband, as a scientist who was attacked during the COVID epidemic, myself as an educator around social-emotional learning and substance use prevention and that kind of stuff, it's hard to have empathy for other people these days. So in place of trying to maintain my empathy for other people 24/7, I'm giving myself some grace and letting myself employ that empathy around bears and wasps and even these little mites that are killing off the honeybees. It's hard to have empathy and take the perspective of a tiny little creature that's killing off our bees, but they're creatures too, and they're awfully resilient little creatures. When you learn more about what mites do, it's fascinating. Like, they emerge from the cells where bees are born. They emerge from those things already pregnant with the next generation of mites. And that adaptive behavior is crazy. And it's, again, awe-inspiring, but they are killing our bees, so.
You know, what you described kind of reminds me that I try to come to terms with weeds without doing a full eradication program, that kind of an approach to things. Well, you mentioned wasps. Those are, you know, they come with stingers. That's a problem too. The empathy for wasps.
So I've been building a stone wall this year. We have terrible erosion problems, also due to another creature that it's very hard for me to have empathy for. There is a worm that is invasive, although in this part of the world, all earthworms in New England are non-native to this area because the glaciers scraped all the topsoil off of New England. But we have a particular kind of worm that is really, really destructive called the snake worm or the crazy jumping worm. And I have them. They came in on a load of compost. And when they do what they do to the soil, which is eat up all the nutrients really quickly, they take away any sort of structure in the soil. So erosion happens really quickly.
So when the crazy jumping worm jumps, does it look crazy?
I could show you pictures that would so freak you out. They writhe like snakes. They're the biggest earthworms I've ever seen in person, and they writhe and move like snakes. Yeah, they move quickly, not like any worm you've ever seen, and they outcompete all the other worms, and they eat all of the litter on all of everything in the forest floor, everything in the gardens. They eat everything at once and poop it out all at once. And normally, worm poop is great for your gardens. But in this case, what you end up with is too much of it all at once, and they've completely depleted any possible leaf litter or compost you've put on your soil, and then the soil erodes more quickly.
But what makes you really mad is that they undermine your wall.
Well, they undermined the soil, which meant I had to build the wall, and which meant I had to harvest all the stone. Luckily, there's lots of stone on my property because New England. But the problem is that the yellow jackets, a kind of wasp, live in the ground underneath some of those stones. And so when you move those stones off the forest floor, sometimes you get attacked by wasps. And sometimes they go and rob your honeybee hive. They like honey too. It's a really great source of sugar for them. They also happen to like the water I keep out from my bees all the time. And so they will go to my hive and try to get in there, and the guard bees that sit by the entrance attack them and do their best to keep them out. But yeah, suddenly there were yellow jackets, wasps in my beehive as well. But luckily, there's a book for that. There are lots of books, but there's one in particular that I really enjoyed. It's a book called Endless Forms by I hope I'm pronouncing this right, and I'm probably not. Seirian Sumner. Her name is spelled S-E-I-R-I-A-N Sumner. And it's a beautiful book about wasps. And so the minute I got angry at these wasps, I came in and picked up this book that someone had given me and was trying to understand the wasps a little bit better too, because I didn't want to go out and just blitz them with chemicals, because those chemicals, by the way, if I were to use chemicals on those wasps, those insecticides can also kill my honeybees and lots of other things. So I had to come up with a way to deal with them that did not require the use of chemicals.
I'm going to say you've been down quite a labyrinth with lots of twists and turns. maybe the lights are off in this labyrinth because it can be dark and scary and dangerous because bears.
No. Anytime there's the opportunity to learn new things, it's never dark and scary. There's always light around the next corner, right?
Yeah, but you've never done orchids, you know?
No, actually, I couldn't have. I actually am a master gardener with the state of Vermont, but I don't do houseplants. I don't do fussy plants. As long as it lives outside, I'm good. In fact, I gave away all my houseplants because they were causing me too much stress.
Well, Jessica, it just seems to me that your story, it conveys a lot to me. And I love it all. And
that I have too much time on my hands? Is that what it conveys to you?
Well, you know, when I consider what wonder is, and I kind of go at this from a really deeply felt perspective about our place on this planet and what we're supposed to become, and are we supposed to be empathetic creatures and everything we've been talking about. I think it's so interesting that so many people expect that awe and wonder experiences are going to be pleasant and agreeable.
Not if you're Emily Dickinson, because Emily Dickinson uses the word, she talks about awe in a really interesting way, and I'm not remembering the number of this poem off the top of my head, but there is a wonderful, wonderful poem. You know, Emily Dickinson had some issues. She had a complex psychological picture going on there, but she uses the term awful. Remember, you know, we use the term awe, and something that strikes you with awe strikes you with this wonder. But there's also some fearfulness to it, right? There's to be awful is to be full of awe, right? So when I talk about the word awful, like, oh my gosh, this wasp, it is awful. At the same time, there is the potential for me to come at it from the other perspective and be full of awe Have you ever looked at a paper wasp's nest? They're gorgeous. They're so beautiful. And the way they're built is fascinating. And I think there's this line between, yes, that scares me out there, and that's what can lead to fear of snakes or fear of bugs or fear of the dark. And yet at the same time, out in that dark are the lightning bugs and the sounds of the owls and the bats and all of the cool things that we may not see if we're not willing to step into that place, you know, where there's a little bit of fear but also a lot of awe. I love that place.
Give me the last time, the most recent time you went out and were just gobsmacked by the beauty of the danger.
So a couple days ago, there's a flower in my garden called bee balm, and it's bright red. I didn't plant it for my bees because they don't see red. I planted it for the hummingbirds and some other pollinators. So the big patch of bee balm gets a lot of traffic from hummingbirds, and there's a couple of them, and I have to read more about hummingbirds because I don't know, but they seem to be somewhat territorial about it because it does not appear to be just sort of them dealing with each other on a social level, because they dive bomb each other. And these birds are tiny. Some of them, you know, they couldn't weigh more than a couple of ounces, and yet they're bashing into each other in the air and knocking each other out of the air. And I just was overwhelmed by the danger for this little delicate thing, this tiny little delicate bird that can barely maintain its own metabolism because it's going so fast that they're out there knocking each other out of the air just to get at the better nectar. The garden, it's just an amazing place out there. All sorts of writers talk about this. Emily Dickinson, of course, happens to be one of them, where just stepping outside of her house and looking at what was around her was an endless source of poetry and awe and fear and wonder for her. So I have bits of her poetry around the house. I like taking my cue from her.
Jessica Leahy is author of the book The Gift of Failure and also the book titled The Addiction Inoculation. She also hosts the podcast #mwriting. And you can find more of her adventures with bees on Instagram and Substack. We'd love to hear from you. Write to us at any time by email, constantwonder@byu.edu. And if you enjoy what you're hearing, we'd love you to pass word around with all your friends. This episode was produced by Jess Scoville with assistance from Lydia McElroy and sound design by Ted Kim. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.
As a dad myself, I know it's a happy moment when I come across a podcast just right for the whole family. And we've got just the thing for you, Constant Wonder Kids. Constant Wonder Kids offers stories from the original BYU radio podcast, Constant Wonder, with accessible adventures for younger hearts and minds. Constant Wonder Kids goes out into wide open nature. It's designed for curious kids, but then of course also for the grown-ups who love those kids. Together, you can discover fascinating facts, true stories about remarkable people we interview who have had incredible experiences in their own encounters with nature. You get to join them as they dive down far under the ocean surface to meet things like, oh, maybe a friendly whale shark. Or back on land, you get to cheer along for tiny little hedgehogs that are athletes, if you can believe it, at the International Hedgehog Olympic Games. Constant Wonder Kids is perfect for road trips, for bedtime listening, or whenever your brain's got an itch that needs to be scratched. New episodes drop on Mondays. Tune in to Constant Wonder Kids on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.